Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. The newest film from the Coen brothers gives a whole new meaning to the phrase Wild Wild West. Titled The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, the movie is really a collection of six short films, each with its own unique style and story to tell, but each brought to life with the distinctive Coen brothers flair for the dramatic and love of genre. With each chapter set in the Old West, the film opens with Buster Scruggs himself, a crooning, good-natured, philosophizing cowboy who won't hesitate to shoot up an entire saloon if provoked. The Ballad of Buster Scruggs is available to stream on Netflix, and Buster Scruggs himself, actor Tim Blake Nelson, is here with us now. Welcome to All of It.
Thanks for inviting me. I'm happy to be here.
So this has been in the making since 2002. Is that right, the script?
Well, my story was written in 2002, the story in which I play the character of Buster Scruggs. And as this is an anthology film, they needed four or five more. And so Joel gave me that first script that was about 20 pages long in 2002 and said, we've got to write the others. And when we do, this will be a full-length movie with six vignettes or five vignettes. So hang tight and we'll get back to you. And 15 years later, they had written the other ones and I got to play this role.
It's interesting to watch you play this role, and I had listened to an interview you did with Marc Maron, and you'd mentioned that if you work with the Coen brothers, as you have, that being trained in the classics is helpful, in the classical theater.
In class, yeah, I think being trained in classical theater in the traditional way that continues to be how actors are trained in theater training programs in America is extremely helpful. And by that, I mean that you're steeped in Shakespeare, Restoration comedy, Jacobean revenge dramas, Chekhov, and then also modern playwrights, meaning that you're asked to be comfortable with all sorts of different stylistic conceits. That's particularly helpful with Coen brothers characters in terms of language because they write extraordinary dialogue, but often it's very stylized and the vocabulary can be pretty abstruse.
Tell us a little bit about Buster. He's kind of idiosyncratic. He looks good in white.
Buster Scruggs is a classic singing cowboy when you meet him, which is a sort of ludicrous conceit, and I'm not sure how Hollywood came up with that conceit, but early on in some of the first Westerns that were made, your hero would be a crooner on a horse, usually with a guitar. He would often address camera directly, mm-hmm. And he would sing and gallivant around the West and get involved in adventures, confront black hats and deal with them, usually in a benign and funny way. In the Coen brothers version,
you can say that about almost
different.
Anything.
Like right.
In the Coen
right.
brothers version of the Disney parade.
Yes, exactly.
Mickey's taking LSD.
They would love that. That's very funny. In the Coen brothers version, he's, at least from the audience's point of view, not so benign. And he solves problems with violence. So he's a guy whom you don't want to have as your enemy. And he's also a man who lives by a code and eventually dies by that code without resenting anyone, continuing to philosophize benignly as he ascends into heaven.
You had to ride a horse and play a guitar for this role, correct?
That's correct.
Did you know how to do them separately?
Well, I'm an okay rider because I grew up in Oklahoma and I got on horses when I was growing up. And I'm also married to a woman from San Antonio, Texas, and she grew up around horses. And so I've been riding with her and her father. I did not know how to play the guitar, so I had to pick that up pretty quickly. And luckily, I have this 20-year-old son whose name is Henry, and he's at Oberlin Conservatory right now. And he taught me how to play the guitar because he's very, very good at it. And so for about 5.5 months every day, I practiced until I could accompany myself on the guitar in really one of the songs I sing, Cool Water, which opens the sequence.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful as well. I mean, just the composition of that shot. It's
that's what you get with Joel and Ethan. They're students of art history, but in particular of the history of photography.
You can tell.
And then they also hire collaborators who are extraordinary. And so Bruno Delbonnel, the director of photography, does, as usual, gorgeous compositional work in this movie. I like to... It's not my original notion. It's commonly known that you can take any frame out of a Coen Brothers film and it would be a still photograph in its own right. Any frame. That's how careful they are compositionally.
We're talking to Tim Blake Nelson. He's part of the new movie, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. And I say part of it because it's this series of vignettes that create this, you find out, ultimate whole story. Because you know the whole story as an actor, as you were creating and working on Buster's character, did you keep in mind the other vignettes, or did you just think about Buster in this 20 minutes that you have with him?
I certainly kept in mind the other vignettes. I read the script about 6 months before we started shooting, and I read everyone's script. We all did, all the actors. And each one was so perspicuously an example of a particular genre that it made you as an actor in your vignette especially responsible to give a foot forward, clear performance that was genre specific. And I also knew that as they started to cast the film, that they were adding Liam Neeson and Harry Melling and Tom Waits and Bill Heck and Zoe Kazan and Brendan Gleeson and James Franco. And so I think we all looked around and said, well, we've got to come through for one another. And those are some pretty extraordinary actors. And I knew that I was going to be in their company in the movie, if not necessarily on screen with them. And so that added further incentive to do the work and do it well.
It's interesting. It's like a collaboration, although you never truly collaborate.
Yeah.
You're collaborators, but you're not collaborating.
Yes, that's exactly right. And now it's great to get to know them all as we talk about the film together.
How have you? How was it to stage some of these grisly fight scenes?
Well,
the choreography of all that.
I didn't do any of the staging. I had certainly my ideas, and they may or may not have helped. I'm not entirely sure, but I can say that Joel and Ethan and this is an element of filmmaking that I think is underappreciated because you don't think of it in a story told with pictures, but they stage scenes really, really beautifully. And they think a lot about the staging of scenes. And Joel and I are close friends. And when we talk about other films, he'll often allude to the staging and the relationship between the staging and where the camera is and how the camera moves in response to the movement of actors. So they're really careful with it. And in terms of the choreography and staging, therefore, I never once felt out of place, unnatural, facing the wrong way in a strange relationship to an acting partner. It all just works with what they ask of you. And that's simply Joel and Ethan.
Had you spent a lot of time around guns?
I have spent some time around guns. Again, my father was a Marine, and so there were guns in the house when I was growing up, and occasionally he would take us out to shoot them. But then, again, I married into a Texas family. My wife is Mexican-American from Texas. But her father was a police officer for 2 decades and then a sheriff. And I've shot a lot of his guns, as have now my children.
That was my next question.
Yes. And I also, in prepping for this role, I was learning to play the guitar and practicing that every day for 5.5 months, but also practicing twirling the pistols because Buster Scruggs is an extravagant gun twirler in the Old West. And so I'm spinning pistols, and that took a lot of training. And I'll just say that bringing them into the house and working with those every day delighted my 3 boys. They loved it. And I often had to yank the pistols away from them so that I could practice.
Dad's got to do work.
Yes.
You obviously have been in Coen Brothers films before. One of my favorite lines that I quote often, "Oh, George, not the livestock."
When I read that line in "O Brother, Where Art Thou?" and realized I was going to get to say it, I thought to myself, this could be my only scene and I could perish at this point, having lived a good life.
I say it at least once a month. "Oh, George, not the livestock," when something goes wrong.
And then Joel and Ethan shot that scene so convincingly, and it was early on in the world of the evolution of digital effects, that PETA came after them insisting that they had killed animals. And they literally had to walk them through and say to the Humane Society, "No, we did not do this.
We did not kill any livestock. If you don't know what we're talking about, go to Google after this interview. Google, "O Brother, Where Art Thou?" and "Don't Kill the Livestock, George." It's a classic. It's so perfect when things just, oh, why'd you do that?
Yeah.
It's perfect.
Joel and Ethan, their throwaway lines could be the best lines in other movies.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. We will be right back. This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. We're back with actor Tim Blake Nelson. His new project is The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. It's streaming now on Netflix, and it's the latest of Tim's fruitful collaborations with the Coen Brothers. You obviously enjoy working with them, and you obviously respect them. What is it that you respect about the way they work, the Coen Brothers?
I guess their generosity and their preparation. They do nothing sloppily. There is nothing ever lame in their movies. And as somebody who directs movies, which I do, I know how difficult that is to achieve, because I look at some of my films and I'm very proud of the movies I've made, but there's definitely lame stuff in them that I regret having shot in a particular way, or I despair over not having had the resources to accomplish a scene the way I might have wished. That just never happens in Joel and Ethan's movies. They apply so much attention to every aspect of the writing, the shooting, what characters are wearing, what the design is around them in terms of the production design, the sound in movies, which is largely done in post-production. The makeup the actors are wearing, what the hair looks like, they are maximalists and they are completists. And that is all about preparation and doing the work over months and months and months so that no decisions that could have been made earlier are made on set. And therefore, that time on set is allocated to the stuff that has to be dealt with on that day. And I think that's all about, as I said, preparation, but it's also generous. They give the audience simply more than almost any other filmmakers give audiences. And that's what I most appreciate about them. I feel, and I'm not alone here. I get to talk to you about it today, which is great. But I'd like to just say I represent anybody who works with Joel and Ethan. It's as if I'm a practitioner in this art form, but I get to go and hang out in Picasso's studio and see how he does it. That's what it's like working with Joel and Ethan.
We're talking with Tim Blake Nelson about his new movie, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. So you started out, you studied what in college? You studied?
I was a classics major.
At Brown University.
Yes, and mainly studied Latin.
Mm-hmm. And I remember you in Mice and Men because I was 2 years behind you.
Oh, my God.
I was waiting to tell you.
That is fantastic.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting.
This is radio, and I'm not just flattering you, but you look like you were class of 1995.
I'll take it. Because that was a really interesting time there. You were there. Laura Linney was there. Maren Hinkle, who's
wonderful actress. Yes.
Marvin Mazel. Peter Jacobson was there. Lynn Nottage was over writing plays.
Yes.
Over with Paula Vogel. It was this really fertile time for...
And right before us, you also had Christine Vachon, the producer, Killer mm-hmm. Films, and then this amazing group of writers, specifically the two that come to mind are Rick Moody yep. and Jeffrey Eugenides.
Yeah, that's right. Kate Burton was an actress there as well.
Right.
It was just a really interesting time to be at that school in the 80s. There was something going on there. I'm not sure what it was.
What attracted me to Brown when I first visited the campus and knew within 10 minutes that this is where I would go if they would have me, was the manifest creative spirit that I saw when I walked on to the green. I couldn't identify a Brown type other than to see that whether it was sartorially or the way people wore their hair or facial hair or the general energy coming out of people, it felt like a place for free spirits and imaginative spirits. And that's what I got. I felt like I was always around imaginative, creative people who were pushing themselves academically.
It was the place where I first realized what true actors were. Because, you know, I showed up to like try to go to like a PW audition or something. Because I'd done like every kid who was...
Acted in high school,
was in the school musical. And I was like, oh, these are real artists. Like, this is what real acting is. I'll go to the radio station.
So you were at BRU?
I was at BRU all 4 years. I'm quite literally made a U-turn and went to Benevolent Street.
Well,
and that's how I ended up having this lovely position.
Well, that's
position.
Lucky for radio, certainly. and I will say that I grew up in Oklahoma, and I found the acting community initially at Brown to be quite intimidating because there just were students there who had already practiced at a level that I couldn't ever imagine approaching. And with an exposure to playwrights that I didn't even know existed. So the kids from New York and Philadelphia and Los Angeles and Chicago who knew about writers like Sam Shepard and John Guare and Arthur Copet and Marcia Norman, they both intrigued, but also, as I said, intimidated me. And I wondered if I'd ever be able to even approach matriculating into that world at Brown. But at the same time, they, like many students at Brown, and I'm sure this is not unique to Brown, but they invited a rube like me in. And I owe so much to that, to those New York kids who'd been seeing plays off Broadway and knew about Steppenwolf and Manhattan Theater Club and Playwrights Horizons, said, yeah, come over and look at this. Isn't it exciting? And shared it.
You've mentioned several times you're from Oklahoma, and there's a really interesting, you have an interesting personal story in your family about your family ending up there because of Hias, is that correct?
That's right.
Could you share that story? Would you mind?
The Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, who were, that's an organization that was adduced very negatively by the killer in Pittsburgh at the
synagogue,
the murderer at the synagogue in Pittsburgh. And this was an organization at the turn of the century that was housed either in the building that currently houses the Public Theater or right next to it in downtown New York. And they dispersed Jews that weren't affiliated with sponsors or families around the United States outside of Eastern Seaboard cities, so that they wouldn't just congregate in New York City or Washington or Philadelphia, that they'd be out in the country forming new communities and therefore would be less vulnerable to roundups as they had been when they were in either cities or shtetls in Europe. And my mother and her parents were sponsored by a family that had been settled by Hias in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And so that's where they were told that they had no choice. They had to move there. And I'm incredibly grateful for that, because I feel like I had the most extraordinary upbringing possible, just because of the contrapuntal nature of coming from a decidedly urbane European ethnic background, but growing up in the Southwest, which couldn't have been more different than that. And the juxtaposition of those seeming incongruities, but also discovering the deeper ways in which they actually cohered in terms of values and ethics, was a great way to grow up. And I'm extraordinarily grateful for it.
And then you pop to the Northeast for undergrad. You come down to New York to go to Juilliard for 4 years.
That's correct. That's right.
And you've made your home in New York.
Yes. I married a woman from Texas, my wife Lisa, who's now a professor at NYU. And we had three children. My wife used to say, we're from Texas and Oklahoma, and we're not going to raise kids who at a certain point in their life are going to be at just the height to breathe in exhaust fumes from city buses. But it's just what we did, because we've never been able to leave this phenomenally exciting city. And we both now feel we owe so much to having lived here for now several decades.
Before I let you go, what's next for you as an actor, and what's next for you as a director?
Well, I am currently filming Watchmen for HBO, based on the Alan Moore graphic novel. And this is a series that has been created by Damon Lindelof and a guy named Tom Spezialy and this woman named Nicole Cassell. And I'm playing this challenging, mysterious character whom I have grown really to love. And because of an injunction about talking in detail imposed on us by HBO, I can't say much more other than that I'm very excited about this series and what it's bringing up. It's I think going to be not only incredibly entertaining but also quite culturally relevant to our time. And then I have a play that I wrote called Socrates, which is going to be produced at the Public Theater. We go into rehearsals for that in February, and it stars Michael Stuhlbarg playing the title character. It's being directed by Doug Hughes, and we have 15 other wonderful New York theater actors in it, including Tego Bouger, who's going to play the role of Plato, and just a fantastic ensemble of great New York theater actors joining them. And after that, I'm just not sure. That takes me until May, and I'll either direct a film after that or I'll be acting again. I'm not sure. It's all an adventure.
I said last question, but I have one more, so I'm raising my hand.
Sure.
Is this your first play you've written, or have you written others?
No, it's my, I think, fourth or fifth play. I've had two other plays produced in New York. I wrote a play called The Gray Zone, which was done at Manhattan Class Company in 1997, and then I made that into a movie. And then, and that was fairly successful. It extended and did pretty well. And then I wrote another play that they produced called Anadarko, which I liked, but nobody else did.
It was something
of a flop. And then this will be my third play produced in New York, and it's a big, long, expansive evening, and I hope people will come see it. I'm very excited about the production Doug Hughes has planned, and I'm incredibly grateful that the Public Theater is producing it.
How do you write? Do you have a room in your home and you tell everybody, I'm going in there to write? Do you write when you're on set? I'm just amazing that you can fit in writing plays with all you do.
I write wherever I can and whenever I can. So I do a lot of writing during downtime on sets. And there's a great deal of that. And when I'm home and I'm not off on a set, I do have an office, but the door is never closed. And my wife and the kids are in and out of there constantly. And I love that. Or I would get a studio somewhere and I would write elsewhere.
Tim Blake Nelson, it was a pleasure meeting you again.
Thank you very much. And I love the surprise of our having attended Brown together that came up in the middle of this. Thank you very much.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Holiday shopping is already underway. Maybe you finished up for Hanukkah. Maybe you still have Christmas presents to get. The stress is there. It's real, people. And whether it's personal, will I get the perfect gift for a loved one? Or financial, can I afford that perfect gift? And will I tell my significant other what I spent this season? While talking about money and spending can be awkward, not talking about it can be even worse for your relationship. It can lead to something called financial infidelity. That's why I've invited Charlotte Cowles on the show. She's a columnist at New York Magazine's The Cut and writes With Interest, a weekly finance column and newsletter for the New York Times. Her November 30th column in The Cut is called How to Know If Your Partner is Financially Cheating in Your Relationship. Charlotte, welcome to All of It.
Thank you for having me.
You were sharing with me right before you got on the air that you've gotten so much response to this article.
Yeah, I really have. It's one of the biggest questions that people write in about, which is, you know, I just found out that my spouse owes me all this money or has been, you know, spending a lot of money that I don't know about. It's really a big source of conflict in a lot of relationships.
We do want to hear from you, our listeners. Can you tell us, now that you think about it, have you been guilty of financial infidelity and didn't even know it was called that? you want to tell us why or have questions for Charlotte about this issue, of course you can participate anonymously, or maybe you want to offer some advice for someone who might have gotten themselves in this predicament. Our number is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. We're discussing financial infidelity. So let's define it for people. So folks are thinking, do I call in? Do I do this? What is financial infidelity?
Well, that's actually the big question, is that a lot of people commit financial infidelity without even really knowing that they're lying. The psychologists who conducted this study defined it as financial infidelity includes any purposeful deceit involving finances between two individuals who mutually believe that honest communication happens between them. So it can really, it can be omission. It can be, in a lot of cases, it's just kind of being embarrassed maybe that you spent more money on something than you even meant to. And so you're really just trying to put your best foot forward and, you know, maybe tell your spouse that you bought something on sale when it wasn't. Little things like that actually do fall under the umbrella of financial infidelity, even when they're not, they're not ill-intentioned at all.
So something like a secret credit card, that credit card that's just yours on the side.
That would count.
A secret bank account?
Definitely, yeah.
So secret is the word. Secret is the key word.
Or just, you know, omission. I was talking to my dad about this, and my parents have had a very long and happy marriage, and my dad said that he sometimes will buy something and then, you know, sort of hide it away. He's not hiding it. He's not lying about it. But then when my mom notices it, he'll be like, oh, I bought that a while ago. And so then for her, it's not something that, you know, matters quite so much. So it's something like that where it's not really lying, but it's not necessarily telling the whole truth.
Well, there's been some research on this, and you mentioned it in your article, specifically a report in the Journal of Financial Therapy. It was a study by four PhDs at the University of Mississippi, and it was called Financial Infidelity in Couple Relationships. There are a whole bunch of different aspects they describe about financial infidelity. What are some of those?
Yeah, well, it's really, what's interesting about it is the huge range of behaviors that fall in this category. So it can be like what we were just talking about, buying something full price and saying you bought it on sale, spending money on your kids and not telling your spouse about it. And by the way, this does not extend to gifts. So if you lie to your spouse about a present that you bought for them, that's okay. but it can also range into like the really kind of dark territory, such as filing for bankruptcy and not telling your spouse,
oh, wow.
Which sounds like it would be really hard to do, but apparently it has been done. So you can understand why a lot of people might be sort of confused about this definition and might not really see that what they're doing is all that bad.
We've got some calls. Let's go to Bob in Brooklyn. Hi, Bob.
Yes, hello.
How are you?
Well, I'm a clinician. I'm a clinical social worker. And I'd just like to introduce some information about spending being an impulse disorder, just like gambling is an impulse disorder. And lots of people who are engaging in these kinds of behaviors, with or without the knowledge or consent of a spouse or other family members, may have a mental health problem that needs to be treated. And there are anonymous groups, and also one might go on the website ADAA.org, Anxiety and Depression Association of America, National Institute of Mental Health would be somewhere else to look at this. But clearly, this is a mental health problem for many, many people. And the neurobiology of it is very, very similar to that of gambling.
Bob, thanks for the advice. We appreciate it.
All right.
Let's go to Nancy in Manhattan on line two. Hi. Nancy's listening. Maybe Nancy will hear us chat at her. Hi, Nancy, you there?
Yes, I'm there.
Oh, okay.
Hi, Nancy.
So my partner took out a loan, a home loan, and it sort of said it was no big deal and this and that. And then when we sold the place, because he takes care of the finances, I see that he paid off the home loan with the sale price of the apartment. which was sort of okay. But then he took out a major debt, which I co-signed. And he, of course, said, you know, it's not going to be a problem. I'm going to pay it back. This is over $500,000. And 10 years later, he's totally unable to pay it back. And because I'm the co-signer, it appears that I'm responsible if he cannot. And I don't know kind of the next right step. I have said I don't want to be responsible for paying that off, but I'm the working one. So it's a bit of a mess.
That's tough.
I get questions like this all the time. And it, unfortunately, is a really common predicament. And I'm so sorry that you are having to go through this. And you, like many people, don't really realize that your boundary has been crossed until it's been crossed. So like many couples, you didn't establish really strong boundaries before you entered into, you know, sharing your finances. And that's a super common thing, because you assume that when you do need to discuss it, you'll discuss it. Now that you're in this scenario, have you spoken with your partner about this? How have your conversations gone so far?
Not well. I mean, it's an 18-year marriage, and he believes that, you know, we're a team and I should pay off this $625,000 because he can't. And I am not in agreement. I don't want to be responsible for him. But we have kids and he can't. So I'm in sort of an impossible situation where if I do it, then it's very difficult to respect him as a partner. If I don't do it, that will be the end of the marriage, it seems. I'm trying to figure out if there are any other options. That feels very black and white to me.
Yeah, I hear that. There aren't a whole lot of options in terms of the actual debt forgiveness, but I do think that it's really worth sharing. I mean, it always sounds cheesy to just say talk about it, but sharing your concerns with your husband and having him hopefully feel like he can offer some solutions as well, besides just sort of dumping everything on you. I think if you welcome his feedback and ask him to provide some suggestions for ways to solve this issue, then it might feel to him like he is able to contribute something, even if it's not financial. And it might you know, help him actually come up with some ideas of his own to help.
Right. Yeah. We've been through that too, and I appreciate the suggestion. He's remarkably defensive about this.
Sounds like a financial therapist might
it's
be in
true.
Order.
There actually is a whole category of therapy, but particularly for couples, called financial therapy, and they have a website. You can look it up online, and you'll find financial therapists in your area. But also, there was an earlier caller who was pointing out that some people really have issues with compulsive spending and just may not really be able to keep track of spending in the same way that their spouse is, in which case it can be really, really difficult to get on the same page.
That's one of the things you write about in your article, Charlotte, is that being disorganized can often lead to this kind of situation where you find yourself, and sometimes the word shame comes up a lot, the word embarrassed. Tell me how disorganization plays in.
Yeah, it actually plays a huge role. And it's really because a lot of people spend money without really thinking about it. And the majority of Americans don't actually really know where all their money goes. I'm totally guilty of that, especially living in New York City. It's really, you know, you sneeze and you spend money.
Yeah.
So
if you start tracking it, it's shocking.
It really is.
If you use one of those apps like Mint or something like that, they're helpful, but it's shocking.
It really is. It's tough to look at yourself, sort of face the mirror in that way. But it also, you know, they say that you can't, it's the same thing in any other aspect of a relationship where you can't expect a partner to fix you. So if you aren't really able to keep track of your money and you have a lot of trouble managing your spending, then even if you marry someone or partner with someone who's really scrupulous about their money, it's not going to change you. So what you really need to do is get square with your own issues around money. And it can be helpful to do that with a partner, but you really need to take a hard look at yourself first.
We're talking to Charlotte Cowles about her piece, How to Know If Your Partner is Financially Cheating in Your Relationship. There was something that's interesting in the comment section. People really went after the idea of separate bank accounts.
Oh, yeah.
That was, I mean, a fiery debate mm-hmm. about it. In terms of the research you've done and the research on this, what is it an individual choice or is there a better way? Is there a way that will ensure a more positive outcome in terms of the relationship?
Yeah, well, it's fascinating to look at some of the data because there's a pretty clear correlation in terms of the research that's been done to indicate that people who are totally transparent with all of their finances, so they pool everything, actually do have higher rates of marital satisfaction. But I would also argue that that's generational. Hmm. And people who are getting married now tend to get married later. So by the time they get married, they already have some assets. They have habits that they've established in terms of how they deal with their finances. And so they want to keep their money separate. It's working for them. And they don't really see the point of pooling everything when they already sort of have a system that works for them. And my husband and I are certainly in that same boat, and our shared expenses we communicate about, and the rest of it we trust each other to be able to handle our own spending with the money that we respectively bring in.
If you want to join this conversation about financial infidelity, 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. We're going to take a call from Liz, who is calling us from Brooklyn. Hi, Liz. What's your story?
Hi. My story is I am I guess you can call me a child or of financial infidelity when it comes to how it affects the family. The unfortunate side, and I kind of feel this is generational, of how our parents were brought up and women getting all the finances and everything kind of being dealt by the men, and now afterward dealing with a whole lot of accounts that weren't what was communicated, money that was supposed to be there is not there, things like that. Now that we are unfortunately dealing with the passing of a family member, now we're in this point where it's, oh, so you lied about so much, and now we're dealing with the repercussions. And I just stress, you know, the fact of being forthright about what you're doing is hard to do. Lord knows I'm not the biggest person to do it, but I can totally see what happens when you do this and it affects your whole family afterward.
That's really interesting, Liz. I'm hoping things work out for you. It's so interesting in this report, Charlotte, because they have the 14 behaviors and they all basically, it's about not disclosing, pretend a new purchase is an old one, said I bought something on sale but paid full price, hidden a receipt, taken money out of savings without telling my spouse or my partner, hidden credit card statements, opened a credit card without telling my spouse.
Mm-hmm.
That's at the bottom. I mean, that's the infidelity, right?
Yeah, it really is. And the thing is, again, a lot of this is not meant to hurt someone at all. A lot of times it's just the fact that you're really trying to do your best, and you hope that you can pay off that credit card before your spouse finds out, or you don't want them to be angry about something that you don't think is a big deal, but they might, and so therefore you just keep it to yourself and you hope that it never comes up.
why do these people think they're not committing financial infidelity? That was the interesting part of this. The majority of people said, no, I'm not committing financial infidelity.
Yeah, I think it really, I think part of it is just the language. I mean, infidelity sounds like this scary word, like you're really cheating on someone with somebody else. And in this case, you aren't necessarily, you know, you're not cheating with somebody else. You are really just cheating on somebody who thinks that they can trust you, and you're acting in a way that is deceitful. So while it's not directly harmful in that it is intended to hurt someone, what it does is it creates distance in the relationship, because it's just one thing that you're not on the same page about, and that you clearly aren't able to talk about.
And there's always that fear, that stress of this person's going to find out tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
This person's going to find out the next day.
It's true.
Let's go to Mark in calling from Baldwin. Hi, Mark. Hey, Mark, you there? Caller,
yes, I'm still here.
Yeah, hi. What do you want to add?
Hi. So the question is, starting a new relationship in your middle ages, where you definitely have the habits that have been formed, but you're not realizing the potential that people who have accumulated some assets and habits that could be good if you combine. The question is, how should you approach the conversation later on in life? In this case, your 50s and early 60s.
Great question, Mark.
I love that question. And I actually think that a lot of relationships and marriages would benefit from taking this approach even when people are a lot younger. So, which is to say, even before they have assets to protect. But in your case and what you're asking, there needs to be a moment where you really lay it all on the table and you decide what's yours, what is the other person's, and what is ours. And that will require some negotiation, but I would advocate in these scenarios to put something on paper, get it notarized or made legal in some way. It's almost, I know it sounds really unromantic, but when you are partnering with someone, it's a joint business venture. You are running
a household. You're signing a contract.
Yeah.
You are signing a marriage contract.
Exactly.
So you are legally responsible in many ways. So if this was a business, you'd want to know what the other person had in their business account, right?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, you'd want to know what their expenses were. And in a lot of businesses, just like in a lot of marriages, people sort of divide and conquer. Everybody brings their own strengths and their own weaknesses, and you each kind of take over your respective areas of strength. So I don't think it's that every single financial decision needs to be made together. I mean, that seems unrealistic, to be honest. But you need to be clear about what you discuss and what you don't.
We're talking about financial infidelity, and Kim on line 7 from Jackson, New Jersey. Kim, you have quite a story.
I was engaged. My ex-fiance managed to hide a little over $180,000 worth of credit card debt from me.
No.
And this all just came out. I really wish that I had. I really wish I had heard this even a year or two ago, because every key thing that you're saying is exactly true. And I hope everybody pays attention, because when they come along and they say they're in debt this month or they need money, or if they say, hey, you know, I got that on sale, and then I would find a receipt and it wasn't, he said, oh, I would spend $100, but it was $200. Or, you know, oh, I'm short this month, and I'd give him money and say, okay, here's the money. And he'd go, well, you didn't pay for this bill. And I said, yes, I did pay for that bill. Well, he's like, well, I had to put it towards this bill. So all those, I guess the bottom line is that the true communication wasn't there at the start. Just like you said, the boundaries weren't there because I trusted him. And one thing led to another, and he showed me the finances. And, well, there was other conflicts, too, within the relationship, but that was basically the crux of it.
Wow, Kim, thank you so much and for sharing your story. Really appreciate you calling in. I know it probably wasn't easy to relive. What advice, bottom line, we got about a minute and a half left, for people who are, if they think their partner's engaging in this? How do you start the conversation? What advice can you give us, Charlotte?
I would say come at it with your own honesty first. When you show that you yourself are vulnerable and willing to have a really intimate and open and honest conversation, then that's usually when your partner is most likely to want to do it as well. This study shows that about 50% of people commit one of these acts, behaviors that that fall under the umbrella of financial infidelity. So so it's really common.
And there's a gender dynamic too.
Yeah, yeah, there is, unfortunately. A lot of men, because they still see themselves as the financial decision makers, will behave in ways without telling their female partner. So that's something to bear in mind.
It's a great article to read, and Charlotte links through to those various studies. Charlotte Kells wrote How to Know If Your Partner Is Financially Cheating in Your Relationship. Charlotte, thanks for sharing your reporting and stopping by All of It.
Thank you.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart, and we'll meet you on the other side of the news.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing.
Or politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.